Chapter 8 Paranoid Parenting. A quotation from Kevin Ashworth, Clinical Director, Northwest Anxiety Institute in Portland, Oregon. So many teens have lost the ability to tolerate distress and uncertainty, and a big reason for that is the way we parent them. A few days after Greg and his wife came home from the hospital with their first child, they received an unusual gift in the mail, a shiny red fire extinguisher. Not a toy fire truck, an actual fire extinguisher. What made the gift especially meaningful was that the sender was Lenore Skenazy, an author, journalist, and New York City mother of two. You may know her as America's Worst Mom. Skenazy's journey to infamy began in 2008 when she permitted her 9-year-old son, Izzy, to ride the New York City subway by himself. Izzy had been begging her for weeks to take him someplace he'd never been before and let him find his own way home. So, one sunny Sunday, Skenazy decided the time was right. She took him along on a trip to Bloomingdale's. Confident that Izzy would find his way home and could ask a stranger for help if he needed it, she armed him with a subway map, a metro card, a $20 bill, and several quarters in case he needed to make a call, and then sent him on his way. 45 minutes later, right on time, Izzy arrived home where his father was waiting for him, and was ecstatic about his success and eager to do it again. Skenazy published a column about this little experiment in childhood independence in the New York Sun, describing both Izzy's joy and the horrified reactions she received from other parents who heard what she had allowed Izzy to do. 2 days later, she was on the Today Show, and then MSNBC, Fox News, and NPR. Online message boards were flooded with posts, mostly condemning her decision, though some applauded it. Soon, Skenazy was decried as America's Worst Mom. Most mothers would probably be mortified by that nickname, but Skenazy embraced the title. She had given her son the kind of independence that she and most of today's parents had enjoyed back in the 1970s, when the crime rate was much higher. So why had her choice generated so much outrage and condemnation? Skenazy realized that something was seriously wrong with modern parenting. In response, she created a blog to explain her philosophy and to call attention to the paranoia and overprotection that have become normal features of American parenting. She called it Free Range Kids. Since then, Free Range Kids has grown into a full-fledged movement, including a book of the same name, the reality TV show World's Worst Mom, and a nonprofit called Let Grow, which you can find at letgrow.org. The fire extinguisher was such an apt gift coming from Skenazy, who included a note that read, "See, I care about safety," because the gift represents her message in a nutshell. We should all take reasonable precautions to protect our children's physical safety, for example, by owning a fire extinguisher, but we should not submit to the pull of safetyism, overestimating danger, fetishizing safety, and not accepting any risk, which deprives kids of some of the most valuable experiences in childhood. In Chapter 1, we discussed Nassim Taleb's concept of anti-fragility. We explained how the well-intentioned project of keeping kids safe from peanuts had backfired. It prevented many kids' immune systems from learning that peanut proteins are harmless, which ultimately increased the number of kids who were allergic to peanuts and who could actually die from exposure to them. We suggested that this same dynamic might be partially responsible for the rise of safetyism on college campuses beginning around 2013. In Chapter 7, we discussed Jean Twenge's finding that members of iGen, born in 1995 and later, are having very different childhoods than kids in previous generations had, and are also suffering from much higher levels of anxiety and depression. In this chapter, we look more closely at how American childhood has changed in recent decades. We suggest that modern parenting practices may unwittingly teach children the great untruths, and we examine how parents and elementary schools may unknowingly work together to induct children into the culture of safetyism. The shift to this more fearful and overprotective way of treating children, which began in the 1980s and reached high levels in the 1990s, especially among more educated parents, is our third explanatory thread. To learn more about parenting and childhood, we sought advice from three experts. In addition to Lenore Skenazy, we spoke with Julie Lithcott-Hames, the author of the best-selling book for parents, How to Raise an Adult, and Erica Christakis, an expert in early childhood development and author of The Importance of Being Little. It was Christakis's professional concerns about the effects of over-supervision that led her to write the email about Halloween costumes at Yale, which we described in Chapter 3. These experts all came to the conclusion that modern parenting is preventing kids from growing strong and independent, but each arrived at this conclusion via a different path. Skenazy, through the experiences we just described, Christakis, through her work as a preschool teacher and her research on early childhood education, and Lithcott-Hames, through her experience as the dean of freshmen at Stanford University for more than a decade. All three have also raised children of their own. A parent's worst fear. On May 25, 1979, a few blocks south of New York University, a 6-year-old boy named Eitan Pates persuaded his parents to let him walk the 2 blocks from their apartment to his school bus stop. He never came home, and his body was never found. Anyone who lived in New York at the time probably remembers seeing signs all over the city, and the distraught parents on the evening news pleading for anyone with information to come forward. But it was a second highly publicized murder in 1981 that changed the course of American childhood by initiating a sustained movement to protect children from strangers. Adam Walsh was 6 years old. His mother took him shopping at a Sears in Hollywood, Florida, and let him play at a kiosk promoting a new Atari video game system. The kiosk had attracted a gaggle of older boys, so Adam's mom let him stay there to watch while she went off to the lamp department for a few minutes. A scuffle broke out among the boys over whose turn was next, and the Sears security guards kicked all the boys out of the store. It seems that the other boys then left the scene, and Adam was too shy to speak up and say that his mother was inside. Standing alone outside the store, he was lured into a car by a drifter and serial murderer who promised him toys and candy. 2 weeks later, Adam's severed head was found in a canal 130 miles away. Adam's father, John Walsh, has devoted his life to trying to save other children from suffering a similar fate. He created the Adam Walsh Child Resource Center, which advocated for legislative reform and succeeded in prodding the U.S. government to create the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in 1984. He worked with producers to create the made-for-TV movie Adam, which was seen by 38 million viewers when it first aired. In 1988, Walsh launched a true crime TV show, America's Most Wanted, which presented cases of unsolved crimes, including child abductions, and asked the public for help. Walsh was instrumental in a novel method of disseminating photographs of missing children, printing them on milk cartons, under the big all-caps word, missing. The first such cartons appeared in 1984, and one of the first photos was of Eitan Pates. By the early 1990s, the program had spread, and photos of missing children were reproduced on grocery bags, billboards, pizza boxes, even utility bills. Norms changed, fears grew, and many parents came to believe that if they took their eyes off their children for an instant in any public venue, their kid might be snatched. It no longer felt safe to let kids roam around their neighborhoods unsupervised. The abduction and murder of a child by a stranger is among the most horrific crimes one can imagine. It is also, thankfully, among the rarest. According to the FBI, almost 90% of children who go missing have either miscommunicated their plans, misunderstood directions, or run away from home or foster care, and 99.8% of the time, missing children come home. The vast majority of those who are abducted are taken by a biological parent who does not have custody. The number abducted by a stranger is a tiny fraction of 1% of children reported missing, roughly 100 children per year in a nation with more than 70 million minors. And since the 1990s, the rates of all crimes against children have gone down, while the chances of a kidnapped child surviving the ordeal have gone up. Actual versus imagined risk. The cities and towns in which the parents of iGen were raised were far more dangerous than they are today. Baby boomers and Gen Xers grew up with rising rates of crime and mayhem. Muggings were a normal part of urban life, and city dwellers sometimes carried muggers' money in a cheap wallet so they would not have to hand over their real wallet. Heroin syringes and later crack vials became common city sights. When you combine the giant crime wave that began in the 1960s with the rapid spread of cable TV in the 1980s, including news channels that offered round-the-clock coverage of missing child cases, you can see why American parents grew fearful and defensive by the 1990s. The crime wave ended rather abruptly in the early 1990s, when rates of nearly all crimes began to plummet all over the United States. In 2013, for example, the murder rate dropped to the same level it had been at 60 years earlier. Nevertheless, the fear of crime did not diminish along with the crime rate, and the new habits of fearful parenting seem to have become new national norms. American parenting is now wildly out of sync with the actual risk that strangers pose to children. To see how far into safetyism some parents have gone, consider the Missouri family that staged a kidnapping of their own 6-year-old son in 2015. They wanted to teach him a lesson about how dangerous it is to be friendly to strangers. After getting off his school bus, the boy was lured into a pickup truck by his aunt's coworker. The man then told the little boy that he would never see his mommy again, according to the sheriff's statement. The police also reported that the man covered the boy's face with a jacket so he couldn't tell he was being taken into his own basement. The boy was tied up, threatened with a gun, and told he would be sold into sex slavery. Of course, few parents would ever terrorize their children in this way, but less extreme forms of safetyism are taught in subtler ways. Lithcott Hames and Scanese both shared stories with us about parents who were afraid to let their teenagers ride their bikes to neighbors' houses. A psychologist who writes for HealthyChildren.org reported that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children feels that children of any age should not be permitted to use public restrooms alone. While referencing her own 9-year-old son, the psychologist offered these tips. 1. Never send a child into a public restroom alone. 2. Instruct your child to use a private bathroom stall rather than a urinal. 3. Avoid restrooms with more than one entrance. 4. Stand in the door and talk to your child throughout their time in the bathroom. We can understand a mother's fear that her son might encounter a pervert in a public restroom, but wouldn't it be better to teach the boy to recognize perverted or inappropriate bathroom behavior, so he can get away from it on those very rare occasions when he might encounter it, rather than teaching him to fear for his life and maintain verbal contact with a parent every time he needs to use a public restroom? The dangers of safetyism. If you spend time on Facebook, you've probably seen posts with titles like 8 Reasons Children of the 1970s Should All Be Dead. Reason number 1, lawn darts. Reason number 4, tanning oil instead of sunscreen. Such posts are shared widely by children of the 1970s, like us, because they allow our generation to laugh at the safety concerns of today's parents and to point out that when we grew up, nobody wore seatbelts or bike helmets, most of the adults smoked, even around children, paint and gasoline were leaded, and children were encouraged to go on their own to parks and playgrounds where anyone could kidnap them. While the tone is frequently mocking and dismissive, these posts also highlight some important successes in the pursuit of child safety. Increased use of seatbelts has saved many lives. Bicycle helmets lower the risk of traumatic brain injuries. Not smoking around children confers many health benefits on the kids. And removing lead from paint and gasoline has prevented untold numbers of medical problems and deaths. Putting it all together, from 1960 to 1990, there was a 48% reduction in deaths from unintended injuries and accidents among kids between 5 and 14 years of age, and a 57% drop in deaths of younger kids, ages 1 to 4. The success of childhood safety campaigns helps explain why modern parents often take a concern about safety to the extreme of safetyism. After all, if focusing on big threats produces such dividends, why not go further and make childhood as close to perfectly safe as possible? A problem with this kind of thinking is that when we attempt to produce perfectly safe systems, we almost inevitably create new and unforeseen problems. For example, efforts to prevent financial instability by bailing out companies can lead to larger and more destructive crashes later on. Efforts to protect forests by putting out small fires can allow dead wood to build up, eventually leading to catastrophic fires far worse than the sum of the smaller fires that were prevented. Safety rules and programs, like most efforts to change complex systems, often have unintended consequences. Sometimes these consequences are so bad that the intended beneficiaries are worse off than if nothing had been done at all. We believe that efforts to protect children from environmental hazards and vehicular accidents have been very good for children. Exposure to lead and cigarette smoke confer no benefits. Being in a car crash without a seatbelt does not make kids more resilient in future car crashes. But efforts to protect kids from risk by preventing them from gaining experience, such as walking to school, climbing a tree, or using sharp scissors, are different. Such protections come with costs, as kids miss out on opportunities to learn skills, independence, and risk assessment. Keeping them indoors also raises their risk of obesity. Skenazy puts the case succinctly. The problem with this everything is dangerous outlook is that overprotectiveness is a danger in and of itself. Lithcott-Hames concurs. I've met parents who won't let their 17-year-old take the subway, and I said to them, "What's your long-term strategy for her?" I see it all around me. I see kids afraid to be alone on the sidewalk. They don't like walking places alone. They don't like biking places alone. And it's probably because they've been basically made to feel that they can be abducted at any moment. As Taleb showed us in Antifragile, by placing a protective shield over our children, we inadvertently stunt their growth and deprive them of the experiences they need to become successful and functional adults. Journalist Hara Estroff Morano has been sounding the alarm about this trend for more than 15 years. As she says, parents are going to ludicrous lengths to take the bumps out of life for their children. However, parental hyperconcern has the net effect of making kids more fragile. Most parents know this on some level, but still find themselves hovering and overprotecting. Even Lithcott-Hames has caught herself. So here I was, highly critical of parents who couldn't let go of their college students. And then one day, when my kid was 10, I leaned over at dinner and began cutting his meat. And I realized in that moment, holy cow, I'm cutting his meat and he's 10. I was babysitting other kids when I was 10, but my own kid needs to have his meat cut. What the hell is up with that? The blame for creating the culture of safetyism does not fall entirely on individual parents. At a fundamental level, overparenting and safetyism are problems of progress, which we mentioned in the introductory chapter. Thankfully, gone are the days when families routinely had 5 or more children and expected 1 or more of them to die. When countries attain material prosperity and women gain educational equality, full political rights, and access to good health care and contraception, birth rates plunge, and most couples have just 1 or 2 children. They invest more time in these fewer, healthier children. In fact, even though mothers today have fewer children and spend far more time working outside the home than they did in 1965, they are spending more total time taking care of their children. Fathers' time with kids has increased even more. Parents spending time with their kids is generally a good thing, but too much close supervision and protection can morph into safetyism. Safetyism takes children who are anti-fragile by nature and turns them into young adults who are more fragile and anxious and therefore more receptive to the untruth of fragility. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. Pressured into overprotection. When parents get together and talk about parenting, it is common to hear condemnations of helicopter parenting. Many parents want to do less hovering and give their kids more freedom, but it's not so easy. There are pressures from other parents, from schools, and even from laws that push parents to be more protective than they would like to be. Skenazy says that societal pressures often prompt parents to engage in worst-first thinking. Unless parents prepare for the worst possible outcomes, they are looked down on by other parents and by teachers for being bad parents, or even America's worst mom. Good parents are expected to believe that their children are in danger every moment they are unsupervised. It gets worse. Parents who reject overparenting and give their kids more freedom can actually be arrested. In 2015, two Florida parents were charged with felony child neglect when they were delayed getting home. Unable to get into his house, their 11-year-old son played with a basketball in their yard for 90 minutes. A neighbor called the police. After being handcuffed, strip-searched, fingerprinted, and held overnight in jail, the parents were arrested for negligence, and the boy and his 4-year-old brother, who had not been left alone, were put in foster care for a month. Even after being returned to their parents, the children were required to attend play therapy. The parents, who had no history of neglecting their children, were mandated to get therapy and take parenting classes. In Bristol, Connecticut, in 2014, a woman left her daughter alone in the car while she went into a CVS pharmacy. This might sound bad to you, especially when you learn that it was summertime and the car windows were all closed. An alert passerby called the police, who were able to open the car door. The police reported that the child was responsive and not in distress. But here's the thing. The girl was 11 years old. She had told her mother that she preferred to wait in the car rather than come into the store. Before the rise of paranoid parenting, 11-year-olds could earn money and learn responsibility by babysitting for neighbors, as my sisters and I did in the 1970s. Now, according to some police departments and local busybodies, 11-year-olds need babysitters themselves. The mother was issued a misdemeanor summons and forced to appear in court. When the police endorse safetyism, it forces parents to overprotect. The police chief of New Albany, Ohio, advises that children should not be allowed outside without supervision until the age of 16. When you combine peer pressure, shaming, and the threat of arrest, it's no wonder that so many American parents simply don't let their kids out of their sight anymore, even though many of those same parents report that their fondest memories of childhood were unsupervised outdoor adventures with friends. Safe books for safe kids. Lenore Skenazy points out that most great children's books involve kids going off on adventures without adult supervision. For parents who don't want to put dangerous ideas in their kids' heads, she and her readers offer a set of classic titles updated for the age of safetyism. Oh, the Places You Won't Go. The Playdates of Huckleberry Finn. Harold and the Purple Sofa. Encyclopedia Brown Solves the Worksheet. Harry Potter and the Sit Still Challenge. Dora in the Ford Explorer, but not without a parent. Class matters. Different explanatory threads matter more for different people, and perhaps the biggest differentiator of life experiences in the United States today is social class. To understand how social class influences parenting practices, we'll draw on two books that combine in-depth profiles of families with sociological theory and data. Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life by University of Pennsylvania sociologist Annette Leroux, and Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis by Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam. Both scholars find that, with respect to parenting practices, social class matters far more than race. So we'll set race aside and focus on the ways that class differences in parenting may be relevant for understanding what is now happening on college campuses. For simplicity, we'll use Leroux's terms, middle class and working class. But middle class means middle class and above, including the upper class. The term working class is used for everyone below middle class, including poor families. The big divide in parenting practices is best seen in the contrast between two kinds of families. Those in which children are raised by two parents who each have four-year college degrees and are married to each other throughout their children's childhood, and those in which children are raised by a single or divorced parent or other relative who does not have a four-year college degree. The first kind of family is very common in the upper third of the socioeconomic spectrum, in which marriage rates are high and divorce rates are low. These families generally employ a parenting style that Leroux calls concerted cultivation. Parents using this style see their task as cultivating their children's talents while stimulating the development of their cognitive and social skills. They fill their children's calendars with adult-guided activities, lessons, and experiences, and they closely monitor what happens in school. They talk with their children a great deal using reasoning and persuasion, and they hardly ever use physical force or physical punishment. The second kind of family is very common in the bottom third of the socioeconomic spectrum, where most children are born to unmarried mothers. These families generally employ a parenting style that Leroux calls natural growth parenting. Working-class parents tend to believe that children will reach maturity without needing much guidance or interference from adults. Children therefore experience long stretches of leisure time, child-initiated play, clear boundaries between adults and children, and daily interactions with kin. Parents spend less time talking with their children and reason with them far less compared with middle-class parents. They also give more orders and directives, and they sometimes use spanking or physical discipline. From these descriptions, it would seem that working-class kids have one advantage. They get more unstructured and unsupervised playtime, which, as we'll say in the next chapter, is very good for developing social skills and a sense of autonomy. In fact, Putnam points to this class difference as something relatively new and very important. He notes that the parents of baby boomers were strongly influenced by the writings of child-rearing expert Dr. Benjamin Spock, who taught that children should be permitted to develop at their own pace, not pushed to meet the schedules and rules of adult life. Spock encouraged parents to relax and let children be children, and indeed, baby boomers and Gen X children were generally given the freedom to roam around their neighborhoods and play without adult supervision. But Putnam notes that beginning in the 1980s and accelerating in the 1990s, the dominant ideas and social norms about good parenting had shifted from Spock's permissive parenting to a new model of intensive parenting, which essentially describes Leroux's concerted cultivation. This change happened primarily among middle-class parents, who were immersed in news reports about the importance of early stimulation. For example, the erroneous idea that babies who listen to Mozart will become smarter, and who wanted to give their children every possible advantage in the increasingly competitive race to get into a good college. This shift did not happen among working-class parents. The change in middle-class parenting norms is crucial for our story. Putnam identifies the shift as kicking in just before iGen was born. To the extent that iGen college students are behaving differently from previous generations of college students, a contributing factor may be that, compared with previous generations, middle-class iGen and late millennial students were overscheduled and overparented as children. It would be a mistake, however, to think that working-class kids had an overall advantage. Putnam and Leroux both note a variety of factors that make it harder for working-class kids to succeed in general, and in college in particular, even if they are admitted to selective universities. One is that all those organized activities help to familiarize middle-class children with the ways of adults in professional settings and adult-run institutions. Parental modeling gives them a sense that institutions can be made to serve their needs if they can make the right argument to the right person at the right time. Working-class kids, in contrast, have generally had less exposure to adult institutions and have not seen their parents engage with these institutions with the same sense of strength, rights, or entitlement to good treatment. Working-class kids are therefore more likely to feel like fish out of water in college. This may have contributed to the feelings of not belonging that Olivia wrote about, from the Claremont McKenna College story we presented in Chapter 3. Compared with middle-class kids, the second major disadvantage plaguing working-class kids is that they are more likely to have been affected by chronic and severe adversity. In the 1990s, a group of researchers developed a survey to standardize the assessment of Adverse Childhood Experiences, ACE. The survey asked people to report which items from a list of 10 they had been exposed to in childhood, things like parents separated or divorced, you lacked food or clothes, or your parents were too drunk or high to care for you, felt no one in family loved or supported you, adult sexually abused you. As the number of yes responses increases beyond 2, measures of health and success in adulthood tend to decline, and this introduces an important complication to our story about antifragility. Severe adversity that hits kids early, especially in the absence of secure and loving attachment relationships with adults, does not make them stronger, it makes them weaker. Chronic severe adversity creates toxic stress. It resets children's stress responses to kick in more readily and for longer periods in the future. Putnam summarizes the findings like this. Moderate stress, buffered by supportive adults, is not necessarily harmful and may even be helpful in that it can promote the development of coping skills. On the other hand, severe and chronic stress, especially if unbuffered by supportive adults, can disrupt the basic executive functions that govern how various parts of the brain work together to address challenges and solve problems. Consequently, children who experience toxic stress have trouble concentrating, controlling impulsive behavior, and following directions. Kids raised in families below the middle class score much higher, on average, on the ACE survey. Their family situations tend to be more unstable, their economic lives are often precarious, and they are much more likely to witness violence or be victims of violence. This means that even if they make it to college, they may still be carrying scars and disadvantages with them. And in order to thrive in college, they may need different kinds of support than are appropriate for their wealthier peers whose brains were shaped by concerted cultivation. The lesson we draw from this brief review of research on social class and parenting is that although kids are naturally anti-fragile, there are two very different ways to damage their development. One is to neglect and underprotect them, exposing them early to severe and chronic adversity. This has happened to some of today's college students, particularly those from working class or poor families. The other is to over-monitor and overprotect them, denying them the thousands of small challenges, risks, and adversities that they need to face on their own in order to become strong and resilient adults. America's selective universities are dominated by children from the upper class and upper middle class. A recent analysis found that at 38 top schools, including most of the Ivy League, there are more undergraduate students from families in the top 1% of the income distribution than from the bottom 60%. This means that overparenting is probably a much greater cause of fragility on such campuses than is underparenting. Safe and unwise. Paranoid parenting and the cult of safetyism teach kids some of the specific cognitive distortions that we discussed in Chapter 1. We asked Scanese which of the distortions she encounters most often in her work with parents. Almost all of them, she said. Scanese sees discounting positives when parents overmonitor. She says, any upside to free, unsupervised time, joy, independence, problem-solving, resilience, is seen as trivial compared to the infinite harm the child could suffer without you there. There is nothing positive but safety. Parents also use negative filtering frequently, Scanese says. Parents are saying, look at all the foods, activities, words, people that could harm our kids, rather than, I'm so glad we've finally overcome diphtheria, polio, and famine. She also points out the ways that parents use dichotomous thinking. If something isn't 100% safe, it's dangerous. Paranoid parenting is a powerful way to teach kids all three of the great untruths. We convince children that the world is full of danger, Evil lurks in the shadows, on the streets, and in public parks and restrooms. Kids raised in this way are emotionally prepared to embrace the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people, a worldview that makes them fear and suspect strangers. We teach children to monitor themselves for the degree to which they feel unsafe, and then talk about how unsafe they feel. They may come to believe that feeling unsafe, the feeling of being uncomfortable or anxious, is a reliable sign that they are unsafe. The untruth of emotional reasoning. Always trust your feelings. Finally, feeling these emotions is unpleasant. Therefore, children may conclude, the feelings are dangerous in and of themselves. Stress will harm them if it doesn't kill them. The untruth of fragility. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. If children develop the habit of thinking in these ways when they are young, they are likely to develop corresponding schemas that guide the way they interpret new situations in high school and college. They may see more danger in their environment and more hostile intent in the actions of others. They may be more likely than kids in previous generations to believe that they should flee or avoid anything that could be construed as even a minor threat. They may be more likely to interpret words, books, and ideas in terms of safety versus danger or good versus evil, rather than using dimensions that would promote learning, such as true versus false or fascinating versus uninteresting. While it is easy to see how this way of thinking, when brought to a college campus, could lead to requests for safe spaces, trigger warnings, microaggression training, and bias response teams, it is difficult to see how this way of thinking could produce well-educated, bold, and open-minded college graduates. In sum, 1. Paranoid parenting is our third explanatory thread. 2. When we overprotect children, we harm them. Children are naturally anti-fragile, so overprotection makes them weaker and less resilient later on. 3. Children today have far more restricted childhoods, on average, than those enjoyed by their parents, who grew up in far more dangerous times and yet had many more opportunities to develop their intrinsic anti-fragility. Compared with previous generations, younger millennials and especially members of iGen, born in and after 1995, have been deprived of unsupervised time for play and exploration. They have missed out on many of the challenges, negative experiences, and minor risks that help children develop into strong, competent, and independent adults, as we'll show in the next chapter. 4. Children in the United States and other prosperous countries are safer today than at any other point in history. Yet, for a variety of historical reasons, fear of abduction is still very high among American parents, many of whom have come to believe that children should never be without adult supervision. When children are repeatedly led to believe that the world is dangerous and that they cannot face it alone, we should not be surprised if many of them believe it. 5. Helicopter parenting, combined with laws and social norms that make it hard to give kids unsupervised time, may be having a negative impact on the mental health and resilience of young people today. 6. There are large social class differences in parenting styles. Families in the middle class and above tend to use a style that sociologist Annette Leroux calls concerted cultivation, in contrast to the natural growth parenting used by families in the working class and below. Some college students from wealthier families may have been rendered more fragile from overparenting and over-supervision. College students from poorer backgrounds are exposed to a very different set of risks, including potential exposure to chronic, severe adversity, which is especially detrimental to resilience when children lack caring relationships with adults who can buffer stress and help them turn adversity into growth. 7. Paranoid parenting prepares today's children to embrace the three great untruths, which means that when they go to college, they are psychologically primed to join a culture of safetyism.